Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Aboriginal Tent Embassy in Australia is the site of the longest continuous protest for Indigenous land rights in the world. The embassy was established in 1972 when four Aboriginal activists, Michael Anderson, Billy Craigie, Tony Curry, and Bertie Williams, planted a beach umbrella on the line outside on the lawn outside of Parliament in Canberra, the seat of power for the federal government of Australia. Activist demands included the creation of a state within the Northern Territory of Australia, led by an Aboriginal state parliament, ownership of Aboriginal reserve lands, mining rights for Indigenous people in those lands, the preservation of sacred sites across Australia, and compensation for lands that the Australian government would not return. The Aboriginal Tent Embassy is at the center of the documentary Still We Rise. In the film, today's guest, director John Harvey, explores the colonial forces that stripped Indigenous Australians of their land and the national movement that sprung up on the Parliament lawn. Here is the trailer for Still We Rise.
Being named and branded as a Black Power advocate, my aims are to see that our people are given the justice. 1972, to me, is the year for Aboriginal justice.
For the first time in history, there's an Aboriginal embassy in Canberra.
It's a movement of grassroots people who've had real experiences of oppression, of frustration and violence. And it's because they want to do something about it, trying to get into people's heads and to change what they're thinking about us.
The white man came with a gun and he took the land. None of it's been paid for, so it must have been stolen.
People in this country were conservationists, but now they're expected to jump into the competitive European style of life, when actually we're finding that industrialisation is going to pollute the whole world and that conservation is the only answer.
Land rights now! Land rights now! Land rights now! Land rights now!
Do you endorse everything, literally everything, that your officers did there this morning?
I do endorse the action of the police who had to execute a law.
This institution is not a democracy. It's a front for big mining companies.
The mining lobby was too powerful. The pastoral industry was too powerful. And the Commonwealth government didn't have the will to stand up to those vested interest groups.
We believe that the laws of Australia, as made by Parliament and upheld by the courts, are the basis of our society.
To white people, it's money, and they're getting rich off your blood and guts.
Welcome to colour television.
And that is the trailer for the documentary Still We Rise. If you're in the Bay Area, Still We Rise will screen on May 19th at 3:30 p.m. at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland as part of the CAM Film Fest, the Center for Asian American Media Film Fest. You can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. Today we are joined by John Harvey, an Indigenous filmmaker from Saibai in the Torres Strait Islands and director of Still We Rise. John Harvey is creative director of independent theater and the film company Brown Cabs. He's produced and directed a number of films. Hi, John. Congratulations on this great film, and thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Rose. Thanks for having me.
Good morning.
Thank you.
You know, I first wonder, did you grow up, when you went to school, learning about the Aboriginal Tent Embassy?
No, not so much. Not so much here. I think our education system has improved over the years, but there was, very little education about the Tent Embassy at school.
When did you first learn about it and decide to make a film about it?
It wasn't until after school that I learned about the embassy. And in 2022, it was coming up to the 50-year anniversary of the Tent Embassy, and our national broadcaster here, ABC, wanted to acknowledge the 50-year anniversary. So, you know, the opportunity came up to make a film about the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, which is great.
And I think what's so effective about the film is it's made entirely of archival material. So there's a lot of news footage. It seems like footage from other films. I mean, it's very powerful footage.
Yes, thanks, Rose. It started with our broadcaster was opening their archive to make the film. And so as a filmmaker, that was an incredible opportunity. And I thought it would give, by having the archival material, we'd give first-hand accounts from the people who were there. And in the film, I wanted to really capture the energy of 1972. There was a lot of change in Australia. There was a lot happening in the world. And I wanted to try and bring that energy to the film.
Can you talk about how you went about finding this footage? And, I mean, what a process. Of course, this takes a lot of time. And what really stood out for you when you and your team watched so much of this footage?
Yeah, it was quite a process. I don't know how many hours we watched, but we were fortunate to have Dr. Gary Foley as a consultant on the film, and he was one of the young activists at the time at the Aboriginal Tent Embassy in 1972, and he's since done his PhD around the subject. And so, you know, I had a conversation with him, and one of the things he said to me right at the start of making the film was context is everything. And so for me, I thought about that, and I thought about how protests were shown on television. And, you know, obviously on the news, it's a 5-second or 10-second grab of the protesters, angry protesters clashing with police. And I wanted to give people an insight into what people were standing up for, you know, what the protesters, what the activists were standing up for at the time. So for me, it was about providing context for that. So I kind of used that to lead lead my thinking about what footage we might show to provide context.
You know, watching this film, I was also thinking about the history of Australia and the history of Aboriginals in Australia. And given that we're in the Bay Area and it's mostly people in the U.S. listening to this film, I mean, to the show, John, the work that you did on the film, the film festivals that you have visited, you've met a lot of people in the audiences. What are your thoughts about what Americans know or don't know about the history of Australia? That's just something that I was thinking a lot about when I watched your film.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I've had a few screenings in the States, and I think the audience has, been quite responsive to the films and to the film, and I think. I think people are surprised to learn about the history of Australia. I'm not sure what the perception is, but I guess about the First Nation land rights struggles that were happening here. But I also find that people can see similarities within their own country, and people who might know of, the Red Power movement, the Indigenous Native American movement for rights as well, and of course the connection with the Black Power movement between what happened in Australia and of course being inspired by what was happening in the Black Power movement in the US.
Right. I thought a lot about those similarities watching the film because we have the Land Back movement here in the United States, and then, of course, such a rich history with the Black Power movement and the Black Panther movement in the United States. And so I'd love to give out the phone number. I think also about the media coverage that we get about Australia in the United States, just in passing. If you're just going to websites, maybe flipping through a paper, I mean, right now there's a major coral bleaching happening at the Barrier Reef. But I feel like Australia doesn't get that much media attention in the U.S. So if you have any questions for John Harvey about the history of Aboriginals in Australia and Aboriginal activism in Australia, if you're connected to any of this, we'd love to hear from you. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. You know, in addition to learning about what happened in 1972, the year that this protest movement really took off, although it happened, of course, before then, you do a really good job in the film of exploring what happened in various communities when people lost their rights. So, for example, there's one scene in the film in 1971, the Yolngu, they lost their first land rights case in Australia. And a man in the film, I'm going to try to pronounce his name, Munger Rawi Yungapunga, said the missionaries came and our law began to change. Then the mining industry appeared with claws and started moving and pushing us on this, our land. So can you talk more about this? You and your team do a great job of picking different points around Australia to look at what happened to Aboriginals who lost their land.
Yeah, thank you. I think an important part of the protest, the Aboriginal Tent Embassy, was that it was the first time really in this country that the Indigenous voice from across the country came together into one voice. And, you know, prior to that, you know, communities were right across the country were fighting their own battles for land rights and civil rights. And so given that it was this kind of national focus and it was the first time it had, you know, national media focused, I think it even ended up on the New York Times. It started to get international focus for Indigenous rights here. And we wanted to show this kind of national context for the protest. And so part of that was going around the country and, you know, I think, you know, the Yolngu people being the first people who lost their land rights case. And you know, the first time that they'd actually heard about, you know, the government wanting to, you know, acquire the land for mining was on the news. So, you know, it came to them as a shock. And also, you know, by having that court case and going through that Western legal framework, you know, it was also obviously a shock for them to realise that their ownership of land, that their connection, whilst their connection was acknowledged, their ownership wasn't acknowledged through this Western court system.
Right. We heard a lot about that from the activists about this Western way of life. And we'll play a couple of clips during the show about how the activists were treated by the media. I mean, that's really incredible footage. So this is interesting context that so many Indigenous people lost their lands in different pockets of Australia and were fighting separately. And then when the four activists decided to plant that umbrella on the lawn in Canberra, that's when there was a lot of coalescing. So let's go back to 1972. Can you tell us more about these four activists who decided on that day to plant that beach umbrella? Michael Anderson, Billy Craigie, Tony Curry, and Bertie Williams.
Yeah, those four activists were part of the movement, the Indigenous rights movement that was happening out of Sydney, here in a suburb called, particularly in a suburb called Redfern, which was an inner city suburb. And things were being implemented there where the community was doing things like setting up an Aboriginal legal service, Aboriginal medical service, a school foods program, even a black theatre as well, where they were starting to get their voices heard. And these things came from some of the activists traveling to the US and learning about the Black Power movement over there and what was being done to empower communities at a local level. And, you know, it was decided in a meeting there that, you know, that they would set up an Aboriginal tent embassy on the front lawns of Parliament House. So at the seat of power in Australia, they would set up this tent embassy. And it was really clever because they wanted to speak to as many Australians as they could. They knew that a lot of non-Indigenous Australians didn't know much about the Aboriginal land rights struggle and Indigenous issues. So the idea of it was this really kind of David and Goliath, almost an art installation in a way, you know, that would embarrass the government but would also speak to people at home who are sitting on their couches watching the news.
And part of the tent embassy was founded in response to a government policy that sidestepped Aboriginal land rights and instead said that Indigenous people would be granted leases. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, that's right, which effectively meant that people would be leasing their own land, which doesn't make any sense at all. You know, if you have the ownership of the land, it's your land. And, you know, the argument is that, you know, there was never a treaty for the land. There was never any contract of sale for the lands. There was never any exchange process for the lands, you know, except from a violent colonial process. And, you know, so that's kind of what the protest was about. And also I think it was important to say that at that time there was a lot of change within Australia. There was protest for other things that were happening. There was an energy and a growing consciousness within the country, you know, with, you know, the Vietnam War was happening. There were protests about the Vietnam War. There were protests about the South African apartheid and the South African rugby team that toured Australia. And boycotts with South Africa, women's rights movement. There was a lot of energy and a lot of shift, I think, within sort of the Australians' consciousness around particular issues. And Gary Foley often talks about that with the land rights and with the tent embassy, it kind of tapped into that energy and was able to gain sort of more widespread support for land rights.
John, we found an article from the New York Times about the tent embassy published March 8, 1972. And here's what it says. Alarm rippled through conservative political circles in Australia when a spokesman for the self-styled Aboriginal Embassy, a tent camp of young Aborigines on the broad lawn in front of the Parliament building here, announced recently that the Peking government had invited 20 Aboriginal activists on a 32-day tour of mainland China as official guests, expenses paid. And we actually see incredible footage of this visit to China. But that's how the New York Times, that was their lead in the article about the tent camp.
Oh, incredible. You found the article. That's amazing. I think that really shows, you know, the interest that this story was getting, that Aboriginal land rights were getting in this country. And it was embarrassing for the Australian government. At the time, it was a conservative government. And, you know, I think all of those young activists had files on them from ASIO, our kind of government secret service agency. And so they were being watched. They, you know, photographed, you know, the quite large files on some of them. About their involvement within the movement, but also, of course, you know, their travel overseas and what they were doing. So there was real kind of concerns from the government's point of view.
What was the relationship like in let's say 1972 between the government and Indigenous Australians?
Yeah, I think what in 1967. We had a referendum in Australia which recognised Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people Indigenous people as citizens of the country that would be counted in our census, and also gave people the vote. And I think off that, there was a lot of hope and that things would change within communities. And I think what you see here is it's really a changing of the guard as well. Like, there was an older generation who were involved in standing up for people's rights prior to that. And then what we see in the early 70s and leading up to 72 is this younger Indigenous activists getting involved in the movement and wanting to do things a different way because they hadn't been heard. There was a real frustration with the lack of change.
You also have footage about how this movement really grew. Initially, again, started by just four people, and then eventually it grew. It got a lot of support from ordinary Australians and non-Indigenous Australians. There's a lot of footage of police breaking up the camp and violently arresting demonstrators. We see that demonstrators were back 3 days later. That time, the police were even more violent. And then the tent embassy inspired others across the country. So then we saw other tents pop up. And then it went up again in Canberra. And this time it looked like it was just too big for the police to break up.
Yes, that's right. That's right. It was too big, and the national media were there covering it. And, you know, it became quite an embarrassment for the government. And I think one of the leaders in an interview, when it was set up quite early on, I think in March, the Indonesian Prime Minister. And if you can imagine, like, you know, it's our equivalent, you know, say to the White House, and, you know, Prime Ministers, heads of state are visiting, and that's where they go. And they've got their cars, and they drive up to the front entrance, the grand entrance of Parliament House. And right across the street is a tent embassy and a number of tents, people's washing, hanging on lines, and people hanging out on the lawns. And it was an absolute embarrassment for the government. And, you know, the activists really knew that they were, you know, becoming the thorn in the side for the Prime Minister at the time. And what also, you know, you see within the film is how the message spreads across the country. And it was quite remarkable, I think, how connected people were and how that message spread and the support spread throughout the country. And again, you know, it was tapping into those kind of civil rights movements that were happening at the time.
Given that you did not grow up learning about this, are students today in Australia learning about this uprising that happened in 1972?
I think there is probably not enough of it. And, you know, I think, you know, but part of this film too was, I think, you know, probably people here in Australia know more American civil rights leaders than Australian civil rights leaders. Mm. And, you know, I think that's a real shame. And you know, I often get the comment in Australia that people didn't know about these characters and what they did, or had heard a little bit but didn't know a lot. And, you know, I think there's something that we have to do as a nation in acknowledging, you know, our history, and particularly our First Nations history, and doing more to share that and what's happened, you know, in the past and even today.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we're spending the hour with John Harvey, an Indigenous filmmaker from Saibai in the Torres Strait Islands in Australia. John has been kind enough to join us. It's 3:30 in the morning in Australia, so thank you, John, for getting up in the middle of the night to join us. He's director of Still We Rise. It's an incredible documentary about the Aboriginal Tent Embassy in Australia. It was established in 1972, and it is still there today. It is the longest continuous protest for Indigenous rights in the world. If you are in the Bay Area, it'll screen on May 19th at 3:30 p.m. at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland as part of the CAM Film Festival. It's the Center for Asian American Media Film Festival. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the San Francisco Unified School District's plan to vote on which schools may close to address declining enrollment. The vote is expected by the end of the year, and if you'd like to provide feedback, today is the deadline. We will be joined tomorrow by former longtime Board of Education member Jill Wins to talk about what this means for students, parents, and the upcoming school year. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email Your Call at kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with John Harvey, an Indigenous filmmaker from Saibai in the Torres Strait Islands in Australia, we're talking about his film Still We Rise, which is about the Aboriginal Tent Embassy in Australia, established in 1972 when four Aboriginal Australian activists planted a beach umbrella on the lawn outside of the Parliament House in Canberra, the seat of power for the federal government of Australia. Their demand was land rights. This Parliament tent embassy, the Aboriginal tent embassy, still stands today. It's the longest continuous protest for Indigenous rights in the world. If you have any questions for John Harvey about this film or about Indigenous history in Australia and the movement that continues today, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Does the conversation about land rights for Indigenous Australians resonate with movements in your community? We'd love to hear from you. Any questions you have about the history of Indigenous rights in Australia, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. And if you're in the Bay Area, Still We Rise will screen on May 19th at 3:30 at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland as part of the CAM Film Festival. And John, for those who are not in the Bay Area and would like to see the film, are there any opportunities in the future to watch it online?
Hopefully. We're working towards that. Yeah.
Okay,
hopefully
great.
Within the U.S., yeah.
Great. And you can find information at yourcallradio.org. You've got amazing footage of media coverage of the tent encampment and also just this incredible exchange of a conversation between activists Bobby Sykes and Paul Cole. They were on an Australian television debate program called Monday Conference, which aired from 1971 to 1979. Before we play this clip, can you talk about just what it was like to find these incredible exchanges between these white TV hosts and Indigenous activists?
Yeah, that was incredible to come across that footage. And, you know, it was remarkable in a few senses because it was pretty much a one-hour interview show. And there were, I think, three or four journalists, white journalists, who were from various newspapers, and as well as the broadcaster, the national broadcaster, as well as some major newspapers at the time. And they spend an hour grilling Paul Coe and Bobby Sykes, who are in their early 20s. And so, and I was just, you know, in awe of both of them. Just how eloquent they were, how they got their points across, how the journalists for the whole hour are really trying to unsettle them. And they're talking a lot about violence, a lot about violence from the community and this broader kind of fear of violence occurring. And, you know, Paul Coe makes a really good point about, you know, the violence is actually being perpetrated by the colonizer and by the colonial forces, and this country was built on colonial violence. So it's quite rich for the journalists to talk about violence coming from Indigenous community.
Well, let's hear a clip. This is from the documentary Still We Rise. This is with activists Bobby Sykes and Paul Cole. They're on an Australian television debate program called Monday Conference. And first, you will hear host Robert Moore provide an introduction.
Tonight on Monday Conference, Paul Coe, a 23-year-old law student and a founder of the Aboriginal Legal Service in Sydney. Bobby Sykes, a freelance journalist and travelling delegate for the Aboriginal Embassy in Canberra. Australia's black militants. The setting up of an embassy and the intensive pressure for land rights comes from a new generation of Aboriginal spokesmen and leaders. On the whole, they're younger, more impatient, and more militant than their predecessors. And in one way or another, what they're about is black power. How much does your getting what you want to get depend on instilling some degree of fear in white Australians?
I don't know if you could consider it fear. I'd say respect would be more the word.
Well,
I think that the white Australian has very little respect for the black Australian. The white Australian has got what he calls respect by violence. And if we're to take a page out of his book, perhaps we will have to use violence too to achieve some degree of respect from the white man. That's the only language he understands.
It's been, you know, it's been written in some places that there's a list of race enemies who, you know, are down for liquidation. Is there anything?
But I haven't seen any list. Have you seen a list?
I think you know, if there's any so-called Black Panther group or Black Power group that is stupid enough to go writing down a list of his enemies that's going to liquidate, now that's absurd. Now, you know, it really is absurd. It's ridiculous.
This might sound a banal question, but do you hate white people?
No, I don't hate white people. Like, you know, I could use the old common phrase, some of my best friends are whites. But I put it this way, I'm not particularly in love with white society as it stands. There are a lot of white young people who are not in love with it. I would like to see a change. I think a change would, it has to come.
Let's talk about the direct action.
The direct black action that Michael Anderson and the rest of the boys at the embassy have taken, or even the kind of direct black action that Dennis Walker is playing up in Queensland. Now, they all have got their own fields in which to act.
Here's a very white question. Are any of them advocating violence?
Now, when you talk about violence, I would like to talk about the violence, the legalised white violence that is perpetrated against black people. The killing of black kids from malnutrition, that to me is white violence. So when you talk about violence, you take into account the 200 years of suppression that black people have had to live under, the legalised white violence that denies us our rights, both human, political, social rights. The classical example, again, is the Akala people's decision. But one white man has got the sole arbitrary power to decide Aboriginal people not to be given land rights.
That is a clip from the documentary Still We Rise with Indigenous activists Bobby Sykes and Paul Coe on an Australian television debate program called Monday Conference, which aired from 1971 to 1979. And we're joined today by John Harvey, the director of the documentary Still We Rise. That was an incredible exchange, John, and I heard you in an interview say that even the use of the cameras and the lighting in the 60s and 70s deserve attention because the studios were lit for lighter skin tone of the reporters and not necessarily for the Indigenous people on the TV set.
Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, film itself is made for lighter skin tones. So there's these kind of inherent biases within, you know, within the communication tools, not to mention people's own kind of perceptions of things which are biased a particular way, hence the discussion around violence. So, you know, it was really interesting in this film to look at that footage and just within the post-production process to do some work on that footage so that the darker skin tones of Indigenous people, you know, we would bring those up a bit more so audiences could make a connection with Indigenous people within the studio. Because, you know, with the lighting, you know, often the Indigenous people would be darker and a bit harder to, slightly harder to build a connection with as an audience. So it was nice to be able to come through the film and make those changes within our post-production process.
I think the conversation around violence was so important. And then also to hear the host say, well, here's a white question.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It was, and you know, that ran for quite a bit of the 1 hour conversation. You know, it just kind of kept coming back to this violence. And, you know, watching it, you really felt that, you know, that it was this kind of, there was a fear, but it was an unreasonable fear. And it was ironic that they were talking about, you know, asking the young activists, are you trying to instill fear within people? Because, you know, certainly the media and the clips that were shown on the news were about instilling fear. You know, what they were showing, these angry people and having these clashes and who's responsible for starting the violence. And, you know, it was all kind of perpetuated around instilling fear. So it was ironic that the journalists are talking about fear and violence in that way.
And is this how the movement for Indigenous land rights in the 70s was broadly covered?
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And I mean, you know, I think to a degree, you know, there's still that coverage in that way within our media around Indigenous issues and, you know, things that are happening within the Indigenous community. There's still a, you know, that colonial gaze is ever present within the kind of media media focus of Indigenous issues.
The film also includes clips from Basically Black, the first TV program written and created by Indigenous Australians, and footage of John Newfong, the first Aboriginal editor of Identity magazine, which was created as a forum for Aboriginal opinions and artistic expressions. Did these ventures change the political conversation that was happening in the 70s?
Absolutely. Thanks for bringing that up. It was quite a big part of the movement in the 70s, because I think, you know, that the young activists who were starting to take these leadership roles within the movement were so frustrated with how they were being perceived within the media and how Indigenous issues in general were being either unheard or perceived wrongly within the broader kind of media landscape. And so they wanted to control. They knew they had to control their own voices. And, you know, they'd had this experience within Redfern of being involved in theatre. And I think what they realised was they could have the stage for an hour or so and have the audience's attention. And they could write, you know, their own stories, their own political satire and takes on the day to make comment. And I think that was a really big part of the movement and the artist involved. Like, the film also has some poems that weave through it from Uturu Noonuckle. And, you know, I think, you know, often we see artists at the forefront of different kind of political movements. And you know, myself as an Indigenous filmmaker, I am part of that legacy that really, you know, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't necessarily have the voice that I do today as a filmmaker. And you know, they really fought hard and paved the way for us all to have a voice within the media landscape.
Today we're speaking with John Harvey, director of the documentary Still We Rise, and I hope you can see the film. If you're in the Bay Area, it'll screen on May 19th at 3:30 at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland, as part of the CAM Film Festival, the Center for Asian American Media Film Festival. And John says that hopefully the film will be available for streaming if you cannot see it in person. We have a couple of questions from listeners via email. Philip writes, growing up here in the 50s and 60s, we were fed a lot of misinformation about the native tribes, as if we, the whites, were doing them a favor for conquering them. But things have changed for the better somewhat. How does that compare with education for children in Australia?
Yeah, I mean, there was probably some parallels there with, you know, in terms of this idea of doing things for people, you know, for their own good. And deciding for them, what is good for them, you know, not consulting, not letting local people decide what is good for them and having conversations. And you know, there's a certain extent of that is still continuing today. And I think, you know, I certainly think over the years there is more understanding of Indigenous issues within this country, just generally across across the population. And I think that that's moved, but I think there's still quite a long way to go. And, you know, things are moving slowly, like some places too. I think just, you know, some places, the naming of places, referring to Indigenous names, you know, as opposed to the colonial name that was given, which was only given, you know, 200 years. So, you know, you think thousands of years it's always been known as something. And in the last 200 years, the name was changed. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, people get upset with that, but I think there is a growing understanding about that. And I think what it helps too is, I think, for people to understand where they live. You know, the colonial process of this country was, there was this fear around this country. It was so far away from England. And, you know, it was wild and untamed, and they needed to tame the land, tame the natives upon the land, and try to make it look like England when it was never England, you know. And I think things that are spoken about and how Indigenous people care for this land are really coming to the front now, as we see sort of, you know, wildfires that occur across the country, climate change. You know, you spoke about the reef earlier. You know, Bobby Sykes within the film, she's talking about, you know, that, you know, this kind of industrial way of being within this country isn't the way forward, and, you know, the environmental effects of that. And that, you know, that those conversations were happening in the early 70s. And, you know, I think there's still a long way to go in this country about understanding how to be within this landscape and how to interact with this landscape so that we have a healthy landscape and healthy communities as well. I think we're starting to open and think and have conversations, but we have a long way to go.
I was curious to find out how many Indigenous Australians are alive today, and it's about 3%, which is about the same percentage of Native people in the United States. Is that right, 3%?
Yes, that's my understanding. Yeah, it's about 3%. And I think, you know, and the colonial kind of contact that people have come, you know, the violence that people have experienced has varied across the country. Like there's been a lot of violence right across the country, but, you know, some places like within the Northern Territory, people are still living on their lands, whereas the East Coast, where much of the population is, people were moved off their lands and they were pushed, you know, there was massacres, people were pushed off into missions, and where they, you know, which was a community where they had to stay, and they weren't able to leave those missions. And, you know, certainly the land rights struggle also spoke about that there needed to be land rights and acknowledgement of land ownership for people who had been pushed off their lands.
Gosh, the stories are just so similar. You know, I was reading this book recently by Wade Davis, who's an ethnobotanist, filmmaker, photographer, called The Wayfinders, Why Ancient Wisdom Matters in the Modern World. And watching your film just reminded me of a few passages in the book. I think it's so important. He writes, "When the British reached the shores of Australia, they were utterly unprepared for the sophistication of the place and its inhabitants, incapable of embracing its wonder. They had no understanding of the challenges of the desert and little sensitivity to the achievement of Aboriginal people who, for over 55,000 years, had thrived as hunters and gatherers and guardians of their world. In all that time, the desire to improve upon the natural world, to tame the rhythm of the wild, had never touched them." And he just goes on to talk about how these settlers just couldn't understand this way of life. And yet it was such an incredible, incredible story when you think about 55,000 years of people living on those lands.
Absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of knowledge there within Indigenous communities, how to live on this land, how to be with this land. And, you know, I think, you know, often, you know, when we think about these historical things, and the important, it's history is important in the way, and particularly this colonial history, for people to understand it, because it's not just Indigenous people who have been stolen and who been stolen in the sense of the knowledge and, you know, the Indigenous ways of being. It's also non-Indigenous people within this country, you know, and by not learning about these histories, you know, that they're being shortchanged as well. And, you know, and I think, you know, it's really important that we're able to have these conversations. There is a lot of knowledge within Indigenous communities and wisdom about, you know, addressing things that are happening today. You know, I know of an Indigenous fire practitioner here who is working with communities and to bring back cultural burns within communities, but working with a wide range of people, with farmers, you know, third generation farmers who are starting to listen to that conversation and understanding that their practices on the land isn't working. It's causing harm to the environment, and consequently, you know, that it's causing harm to their farming practices and their financial bottom line. But they're, you know, in a way, they're kind of forced to think about these issues. And for the first time in this country too, I think, you know, we're seeing farmers and Indigenous people standing side by side when it comes to things like fracking and the impact within the upon the land.
Yeah, actually, I wanted to play one more clip from the film, because you do explore what is happening today. I mean, I had no idea. It was so interesting to learn that this Aboriginal tent embassy actually still stands today, and it's the longest continuous protest for Indigenous rights in the world.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. It still stands today, and it really has become the kind of national, it's still the national hub, I guess, you know, for protests within Canberra, which is our nation's capital.
Well, let's hear a clip from the documentary Still We Rise, and this clip is about the activism happening today in Australia.
Highway protest camps are growing. This is a songline of the Dja'Parong people. And if those trees go, you know, the landscape means nothing then.
I'm prepared to put my body on the line for this. I think enough is enough.
The protest was a demonstration against the NT government lifting a moratorium on fracking. Conrad Rory comes from the MacArthur River area, which has experienced water contamination from mining.
I'm sort of protecting my community, protecting my water, protecting my land, and protecting my family.
These frackers are allowed to come on our land and destroy our water. I would dare say that there's going to be some violence around. This is our lives at threat here. We're not for sale and our land's not for sacrifice.
Warumi, welcome to Gadigal country. I'd like to welcome our brothers and sisters from Borroloola.
Greeting, brothers and sisters. We are all one family, black and white. A climate justice family. Our songline shows all the way forward. They are the key to protection of our country. Culture is stronger than contamination. Water is life. Together we united as a climate justice family. We will win and we will survive. Thank you.
That is a clip from the documentary Still We Rise. It'll screen on May 19th at 3:30 at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland as part of the Center for Asian American Media Film Festival. John Harvey is director of Still We Rise. John, we have just a minute or so left. Can you talk about what it's been like to travel around the world with this film? What kind of response you've received, especially from Indigenous people in other countries?
Yeah, it's been really wonderful to share this story around the world because I think, you know, people have similar experiences, and I've spoken a lot to the producer Anna Grieve about this, and I think, you know, these stories, they're happening, they were happening at a local level, but it's also part of this kind of global movement that was happening as well. And I think I find it really warming to remind myself that, you know, we do have these connections with each other. We all share this place, and it's important we were able to, you know, keep these conversations happening, because what one person is feeling and struggling with in one place, many people are across the globe. And I think, you know, in the world that we live in today, it's important to be aware of that and have that connection. Hmm.
Well, my grandmother was Indigenous to California and my grandfather was Indigenous to Nevada. So it's such a special film in general, but also just because of the history of my family, just to learn about what Indigenous people in Australia have been fighting for and continue to fight for today. So it's been great to meet you, John. Thank you for staying up so late to join us. We really appreciate it. And huge thanks to you and your team for making this great film. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Rose. It's been wonderful.
John Harvey is an Indigenous filmmaker from Saibai in the Torres Strait Islands in Australia and director of the film Still We Rise. And I hope you can take the time to see this incredible documentary. If you're in the Bay Area, it'll screen on May 19th at 3:30 at the New Parkway Theater in Oakland as part of the Center for Asian American Media Film Festival. John says that they are working to ensure that it streams in the near future. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you so much for joining us. I hope you can join us tomorrow. We will be talking about the San Francisco Unified School District preparing to vote on which schools may close to address declining enrollment. That vote is expected by the end of the year. You can provide feedback today. Today is the deadline, and we hope you can join us tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.